Welcome to episode 7 of the Alaski Interview. I'm Jill Nelson. Today you'll hear Marvin's 2020 interview with Roland Warren. Warren led the National Fatherhood Initiative for 11 years and became the president and CEO of CareNet in 2012. CareNet is the largest network of pregnancy resource centers in the nation. And we have Marvin Alaski here now to tell us a bit more about the interview. Marvin, hi.
Hey, Jill.
Well, what made you want to interview Warren?
My wife, Susan, founded the Austin Crisis Pregnancy Center in 1984. I thought we were moving to Texas so I could teach at the University of Texas, which I did, but God, I learned, had a much bigger plan to use Susan to make her an instrument for him in saving the lives of many, many babies over the years. It's still going. And the Pregnancy Center is a CareNet member, so I've followed the organization ever since. And when I learned about Roland and his story, I just really wanted to ask him questions.
Well, I found Roland Warren's personal story very inspirational, and I don't want to give it away before we get into the interview, but I'm hoping you can share with us a little bit about his background and how his journey has given him a real passion for his mission at CareNet.
Well, Roland grew up in Ohio with no dad at home. He made a profession of faith in Christ, but he wasn't involved in church. When he went to Princeton, he played football there, ran track, and had a girlfriend who faced a crisis pregnancy. And the people in the health service at Princeton were pushing her to have an abortion. Don't throw away your college career, have an abortion, then you'll forget about it and be able to move right on. That's the story, and I won't be a spoiler by telling what happened.
We'll save that for the interview. You covered a lot of ground in this interview, everything from politics to the ways CareNet is trying to minister to women who find themselves in crisis pregnancies. What stood out to you?
Guys involved in crisis pregnancies often say, I don't want to be a father. We had one young woman who lived with us for 9 months as she was going through a crisis pregnancy. And yeah, that's what the guy said to her. And Roland says, and I think this is absolutely right, the guys already are fathers. They can't say, I don't want to be a father. They are fathers. And that's important, especially because when a young woman who's not married says, I'm pregnant, the first person she often tells is the boyfriend. He's the first responder. If he says, well, I support whatever decision you make, that's no good. If the guy steps up, shapes up, then she probably will also decide to continue the pregnancy. So the guys are hugely important. In the pro-life movement, we sometimes emphasized only the baby. And then starting in the 90s, a lot of people at CareNet and others were saying, well, love them both. Help the baby, help the mom. And Roland says, hey, help all three of them, because that guy's the first responder and his role in this whole thing is crucial. And by the way, that young woman who lived with us when her baby was born, and by the way, she was hugely courageous in the whole thing. The baby was born, the boyfriend came and fell in love with the baby and then fell in love with her once again. They did get married. They had two other children. And yeah, as far as I know, it's just an amazing story of God's grace. You don't often see this in real life, but they lived happily ever after. Both that girl whose life was in jeopardy and then two more children after that. And it came about because Roland is right. You have to bring the dad into it. And that's exactly what happened there. It happens in other places too. And we just need to do more of that.
Yeah, I like that phrase, first responder. Had you heard that before?
I had not heard that before in relation to crisis pregnancies, but yeah, so true.
Yeah, that makes sense. Warren considers himself relatively new to the pro-life movement and says when he entered the scene, he felt like something was missing. Tell us about that.
Well, sometimes in the pro-life movement, or actually in the pro-abortion movement, the guy is said not to really have any role in the decision-making. It's going to be a choice between a woman and her doctor. And that's a crock anyway, because 95% of the time the woman sees the doctor, the abortionist, only at the time she is getting on the operating table and putting her feet in stirrups. There's no doctor involvement, but there's also no involvement of men in the situation. And yet, men supply 50% of the genetic material. The child is a child not just of the woman, but also of the man. It's different, of course. The child is there within a woman's body, but still the child is an independent entity. He's not part of the woman. This is a human being of his own or her own. And the father should have some role in the decision-making. How exactly that works out is complicated, but the idea that you just forget about the father completely is an idea that basically comes out of hell and leads to the destruction of hundreds of thousands of children. So Roland's thing coming out of the National Fathered Initiative was to emphasize it's not just that you are an innocent bystander, you were very much involved in the beginning of this child, and you should be involved the whole way, and you should be supportive of the woman. You are already a father at this point. Hey, man up, step up, take responsibility. And Roland, I think, is very good at showing people how that should be done.
All right, time to move on to the interview now. Marvin, great to talk with you.
Well, good to talk with you, Jill.
Up next, Marvin Olasky's 2020 conversation with President and CEO of CareNet, Roland Warren.
The Olasky Interview Podcast is made possible by listeners like you. Additional support comes from Samaritan Ministries, a biblical solution to healthcare, where members live out Galatians 6:2 by bearing one another's burdens through prayer and financial support when there's a medical need. More at SamaritanMinistries.org/worldpodcast.
Well, let me ask an easy question. Where did you grow up?
I grew up in Toledo, Ohio.
Okay. And I understand no dad in your home?
Yeah, my mom was a single mother. She and my father split up probably when I was like 5 or 6 or somewhere around that time. And so, yeah, I grew up without my dad in the home primarily.
And she took you to church?
Yeah, well, we went to church. I imagine when I was younger, she probably took us to church on occasion, but we didn't go to church as a family, as a regular thing. I went to church camp every year, probably from the time I was around 10 years old or so. And then I went to Catholic school from the 5th grade through my 12th year. So a lot of my religious instruction came through going to Catholic school and going to church camp.
Right. And was your Catholic school a football powerhouse?
Well, at different points, not while I was there, but at different points in high school, it was. I grew up in Ohio, and football is a big part of the state of Ohio. You know, go Buckeyes. And I played football in high school. I played football in college, and that was a really big part of my life. And in a lot of ways kind of kept me on the straight and narrow for the most part.
What position did you play?
I was a running back.
Okay. And what faith did you have looking back?
Well, I went to Church of God out of Anderson, Indiana. So that was the denomination that my mother and our family was a part of on my mother's side. On my father's side was I guess you call it like a Pentecostal kind of holiness church. I went there on rare occasions, and then, as I said, had the Catholic school background. I never took communion in the Catholic church, but every time I'd go to church camp over the summers, there would be altar calls, and pretty much every year I'd get saved. So I did, that kind of kept me on the straight and narrow from year to year. And then when I got, was in high school, I had a coach who was a Christian. And I think certainly from, that was probably the first time I really started to kind of own the faith in a more independent way, I think, and have a better understanding then. It was my senior year of high school there. But, we always, quote, were Christians.
Right.
My grandfather on my mother's side was a pastor, and there were some ministers on my father's side as well. So we were always, I guess I'd say, churched, so to speak.
Right. So you had some contact with your father?
Yeah. I mean, my father, he lived in the same town. You know, we'd see him at, you know, Christmas, birthdays, stuff like that. But in terms of being involved in my life from a day-to-day perspective, you know, he wasn't really there.
Okay. Was your football coach a kind of father figure?
Not really. I had a stepfather who was kind of a long time. He was a stepfather, like my senior year of high school, my mother married him, but he had been involved with my mom probably from the time I was probably in third grade. So they had dated for a long time. And so I'd say if there was a father figure in my life, he was it. I mean, the kind of first that, you know, you typically have from a father or expect to have from a father, my first baseball mitt, you know, taking me to my, you know, first football game. I like a lot of those firsts that you have. Really, he was the guy that was involved in those things.
Okay. And then Princeton, not Ohio State.
Absolutely. Now, if I had been better in football, Ohio State was the dream. Either Ohio State or Notre Dame. Uh-huh. You know, if you're going to Catholic school that was a football school, you wanted to go to Notre Dame. So, but right. I didn't do well enough in football to get recruited seriously by either one of them. So it was not my lot in life.
But well enough in football to play at Princeton.
Yeah, I did. It was very important for me to be involved in football and be involved in sports. And, you know, looking back on it now, I can really see how that helped me a lot. I mean, just, you know, kind of kept me focused. You know, I played football, ran track. And so just having those seasons, you know, helped me avoid, you know, some of the other stuff maybe that I could have potentially gotten involved in.
Right. And were you involved in a Christian fellowship at Princeton?
Somewhat. A lot of the black students were involved in the gospel choir, which I was involved in, and that sort of served as a bit of a fellowship. But I think, frankly, even when I was there at Princeton, I wasn't a regular at one of the other fellowships.
Right.
But I definitely feel like in a lot of ways, being at Princeton, it sort of gave me an opportunity to kind of deepen my faith and think about some things. And that's where I met my wife. And, you know, so our faith journeys kind of coincided with each other. And that was a real connection for us.
And you met her in your sophomore year. I mean, same dorm, same cafeteria. And
yep. You've seen the video.
So I've seen the video.
Yeah.
And you're walking along and you use one of the corniest lines of all time, but that doesn't hurt the beginning of your relationship, I take it.
No, actually, no. That's a nice girl like you doing out on a night like this. Yeah, I know. It was just what came to mind. And that really started a connection, and we were both in the same dorm, and that really kind of helped us, you know, make a connection there.
Yeah, I know the social milieu. I actually I spent a year at Princeton in 2004, 2005. I, as an undergraduate, went to Yale and was, by my second year, was involved in cohabiting the rest of the way.
Mm.
But my girlfriend at that time, we did not get pregnant.
Mm.
And y'all did.
Yeah.
And that must have been, well, tell us about You talk with her over Christmas break.
Yeah. You know, the interesting thing is, you know, we were both Christians, and we kind of knew what God's standard was around those things, and certainly had a desire in that way. But, you know, it, as I say often, discipline, not just desire, determines a man's destiny. And so although we had some desire, we didn't have the discipline. And we found ourselves pregnant, and that was, you know, a challenge because, you know, just telling people in school about it was, you know, embarrassing and difficult. And people knew we were Christians and very visible and very vocal about that. And then also, you know, having to deliver that news to my mother and also deliver to her father. Her mother had passed away. My wife's mother had passed away when between her junior and senior year of high school. So, you know, delivering that news to both of them was pretty difficult. They were both very disappointed. Her father wasn't a big fan of me to begin with. And my mother, you know, who had gotten pregnant in high school, she was very concerned that I wasn't going to graduate and, you know, that this was going to sort of derail, you know, my life, so to speak, in the way that I suspect that she felt the unplanned pregnancy of my brother derailed her life. But, you know, God was faithful in the middle of that. When she went to student services, she was encouraged to abort because their view was, right. You know, how are you going to graduate from Princeton with a baby? And she wanted to become a doctor. And so how are you going to become a doctor with a baby? That's the conversation that the nurse had with her. And she said, no, I want to get married. I want to have my baby. And, you know, I say often when I talk about this is that, you know, there really wasn't a choice that was laid out for her. The nurse was an older woman, probably a mother herself. She could have said, well, how do we make your choice work? You know, she could have asked about the father. Who's the father? Where's the father? None of that. Of course, you're going to have an abortion. But mm-hmm. we didn't. We, you know, we moved forward with the plan and we got married. And by the time she graduated, we actually had two kids, not one. She took a year off between her sophomore and junior year. I was going into my senior year. So I finished my senior year and then went to work, and she took a year off. And then when I went to work, she went back to school and finished up her junior and senior year at Princeton. And so she graduated and then went on to medical school, and you know, all the stuff that the nurse was saying couldn't happen with her being an undergraduate. It all happened. She graduated, not with one kid, but with two. She went on to become a doctor. She's been practicing almost 25 years now. And so it's really an amazing testament to, you know, God's faithfulness, that even though we may stumble and fall, that you don't want to complicate, you know, one bad decision with two. And we're thankful to God that we didn't do that we went on, that we had our son, and a super smart kid, amazingly smart, went on to Harvard, and, you know, is now married and all that stuff. So, you know, we just see God's faithfulness in the midst of all that.
So do you remember your initial reaction when Yvette told on the phone that she's pregnant?
you know, I don't know that I remember the initial immediate reaction other than, you know, I loved her and wanted to marry her anyway. And I just felt like, well, we're just going to move forward and we're going to do this. And I was surprisingly calm in the midst of it. And I'm not sure where that calmness came from, because we had no visible means to take care of ourselves. Mm-hmm. We had no idea how we were going to feed ourselves, pay our tuition bills, or anything. I guess sometimes you're just so young, you just don't know enough right. to be scared. And we just, you know, we were inseparable before that. So we just said, hey, we're gonna do this, or we're gonna take this one step at a time. We moved into married student housing and just were able to kind of work and find little projects, and God just always seemed to provide a financial opportunity for us to make some money to be able to take care of ourselves. I'd take some extra food sometime from the training table that I'd bring home for her. We took one plate, one cup, one bowl, uh-huh. One set of utensils from the dining hall for both of us, and those were our dishes. Actually, we still have one of the bowls even to this day that's lasted all these years. But it's just amazing how God just provided an opportunity for us to get the financial aid that we need, or to find, you know, the work that we needed in order to support ourselves. And that was it.
Right. So you graduated 1 year before her. Is that the way it worked?
2 years. I graduated in 1983. She graduated in 1985. Michelle Obama was actually in her class.
But did you start at the same time?
No, she was a year behind me.
Okay. And married student housing, was that inexpensive, or I'm just trying to go ahead.
Yeah, I mean, we basically lived in the graduate housing. We were able to get them to consider us as independent. That was a big challenge, because if they didn't consider us independent, then our parents' income would have determined what financial aid we did. And it was again the grace of God that we were able to convince them, look, we're on our own, no one's supporting us, and you know, you got to look at the income that we have. And by the grace of God, it was a real blessing. And they said, okay, you know, you guys have a baby, we're going to consider you as independent students. And so that really helped us in terms of that. And again, the grace of God, they never paid another penny for any of our education from Princeton. We paid all that ourselves, including graduate school, medical school. I went to business school. And, you know, just God provided. And we've never, frankly, never had to take another penny from our parents our entire married life, even. God just provided. In fact, it's kind of the other way around in terms of us being able to bless other people. So it's one of the reasons I'm, pretty passionate about this work, because I've been there. I know how the easy thing would have been just to abort the child and kind of move on. And I understand the temptation to do that. But, I think what inspired us in that moment, that our son wasn't a life worth sacrificing. He was a life worth sacrificing for. And that was really what sort of inspired us. And really for me, it links me to, CareNet's work in a very specific way. And it also really motivates me around, the important role that men play in this. It was my wife's body and her choice. I mean, legally, that was the case. But it was also my responsibility and my decision to be a husband to her and a father to our child growing inside of her impacted her choice. And that's one of the missing pieces, at least as I, as a kind of a newer person to the pro-life movement, if you will, when I kind of came in and started to kind of look at things. And I think that that's a narrative that's been missing, all the focus on, sort of saving the baby, helping the mother, basically this love them both perspective. Which is important, it's missing something. I really think it should be love them all. Because the impact that the father has, that the guy who got her pregnant has on the abortion decision is significant. And for too long in the pro-life movement, there hasn't been as much focus on engaging him and inspiring him to be involved. And I think it's a real miss. And I can see the difference that made in terms of my wife, her hopes and her dreams for her life. And her aspirations for her life, she was able to accomplish those things, but they were very much tied to, the decision that I had to make in that moment, which was to be a husband to her and a father to our child growing inside of it. So she graduated from Princeton, which people would say could never happen. She went on to be a doctor, which a lot of folks said wouldn't happen and is a challenge for someone who has to kind of try to do that, as a single mother, if we don't make an effort to engage the guy who is involved in this process.
Right. That's why I was asking about your initial reaction. If she tells you on the phone, I'm pregnant, and you had said, well, you're going to have an abortion, aren't you? If you had said the same thing she was told at the Student Health Center, what do you think would have happened?
Well, I'm hopeful that she would have steadied up and just said, well, I'm going to have the child anyway. But, that's a very difficult position. Yeah. I mean, I call the guy, I call him the first responder. I mean, if I was to have a heart attack right this moment, right? Mm-hmm. The most important person is the first responder, right? So like the first responder determines the life trajectory of the person who's in a crisis or a difficult place. Well, the guy is typically the first responder. And in fact, we did a national survey where we surveyed women who had abortions, and we asked them, who did you talk to about your abortion? And we gave them a list of all the different folks of who they talked to or consulted with prior to having their abortion. And the number one person ahead of medical professionals, abortion providers, pregnancy centers, their mother, their best friend, their father, anybody, the number one person was the guy who got her pregnant.
Yeah.
He's the first responder. And then we asked the question, who was the most influential in your decision to abort? And guess who it was? Far and away, the guy who got her pregnant. So that's why when I came into the movement and said, well, gosh, what are we doing to engage that guy? He's the most influential. He's not the decision maker, but he's the most influential in the decision. So if you really want to end abortion or, stem the tide of that, then you've got to be engaging the most influential guy. So I think in my situation, obviously I was, 19, 20 years old. I didn't know any of that in terms of like social science or anything else, but my response to her gave her the confidence to say, hey, I can do this. I'm not going to have to walk through this alone. And so I can imagine a woman who has that response, and the guy's response is, well, I support whatever decision you make, which is basically a non-response response, basically kind of shifting total burden of moral, physical, social, financial responsibility to her. And trying to make it like you're supportive, right? That response is not one that kind of leads a woman to say, yeah, I can do this. One of the questions that you always want to talk to a client about, when you're in the client counseling room is, does the father know? The next question a lot of times is, well, what does he think or whatever? And what we've kind of encouraged pregnancy centers to say is the next question should be, why did you tell him? think about that for a second, right? Because I'm confident that a woman didn't tell him so that he could say, I support whatever decision you make. That, because it doesn't matter whether you support whatever decision I make. It's my body, my choice legally. Why did you tell him?
Mm-hmm.
What were you hoping? How were you hoping that he was going to respond? What were you hoping that he was going to say? And I just believe in my heart of hearts, in so many of these situations, they're hoping, and maybe hoping against hope, that he'll say something different. Ideally, I'll be a husband to you and a father to our child growing inside of you. Hey, we can do this. I'm going to be there for you. So from my standpoint, the role of the man is significant. And I'll just say this one last point on that. Even the other side understands that. Why do you think that they're framing this issue as her body and her choice? They want to isolate her from anyone who could be an influence in the other direction. And so that's one of the reasons why the involvement of fathers and really engaging right. that way is so critically important.
Did your survey data actually show women saying, I really hoped that he would say, I want to marry you, I want to be a father? Or do you...
Yeah, we didn't ask that question. But, you know, you can sort of get to that, even if you look at Guttmacher's data in terms of reasons why women have abortions. Why? I don't want to be a single mother. Well, what does that mean? I can't handle the financial burden. I mean, these are the reasons why. Well, all those reasons point to the guy. Right. So when you look at the reasons why women have abortions, they typically are very much kind of geared towards that support mechanism. And, you know, in the 45 years that CareNet's been doing this work, and we've seen again and again and again, you know, in these conversations that we have with women who are at risk for abortion, when the father does step into the picture, does see the ultrasound, does step into the responsibility, guess what? The probability of abortion goes down. And here's one of the ways that you can also get at that in a different way. 86% of the women that have abortions are unmarried. Well, what does that tell you, right? Well, first off, that what's happening with that guy is so significant in terms of the choice of abortion. So it's not surprising when I look at the data that my wife was not abortion minded, so to speak, because of my response, because I said, I'll be a husband to you and a father to our child. And that's why, you know, in terms of talking about the life issue, that you can't just talk about it in terms of the sanctity of life. You also have to talk about it in terms of the sanctity of marriage and family. If 86% of the women that have abortions are unmarried, then if you're really serious about wanting to solve the abortion issue, you're not going to be able to do that unless you rebuild this whole construct around marriage.
Mm-hmm.
And what one of the things Roe v. Wade did that, frankly, that you just don't hear people talk about that much, frankly, is it delinked fatherhood and motherhood in the womb. Historically, men and women both became parents at the point of conception. What Roe v. Wade did basically was says, listen, a mother becomes a parent at the point of conception. A father becomes a parent at the point of birth. So you actually delinked motherhood and fatherhood in the womb. That's a huge, huge change. And I think that, you know, that's one of the challenges that we have in this movement is to make sure that we're relinking those things together. In a very significant way.
You know, back in 1990, I was in with a foundation I was in and actually chairing for a couple of years some meetings of pro-life leaders in Washington. And at that point in 1990, the emphasis was all on the baby.
Mm-hmm.
And Guy Condon, I think, was instrumental during the 1990s in going from that to love them both. But what you're saying, I think, is another and a very important step, love them all.
Yeah.
And I'm very glad you're emphasizing that.
When you think about this issue, you know, from a biblical perspective, there's a narrative there, I call it the nativity narrative, that really supports this in a very significant way. You know, when you think about the birth of Christ, you know, here's Mary with a pregnancy that's unplanned from a human perspective, right? It was in the mind of God, but from Mary's perspective, she had hopes and dreams and aspirations for her life that did not include a child at this time and in this way. And she has all this uncertainty that she's dealing with. How am I going to tell my father, my mother? What's my community going to say? How am I going to take care of this child? And what does Mary do? She says what? Let it be unto me as you have said. In other words, that this child is not a life worth sacrificing, but a life worth sacrificing for. And she says, let it be unto me as you have said. So when I start to frame it that way, what I realize is that the core of what you're trying to do when you're talking to a woman who's facing a pregnancy decision is encourage her to tap into her inner Mary. And to say, mm-hmm. as Mary said, let it be unto me as you have said, despite all the uncertainty. Now, my observation was that for most folks in the pro-life movement, that's where the story ends. But when you look at that biblical narrative in the first chapter, the first book of the New Testament, what do you find? What did God do to make sure that Mary's unplanned pregnancy wasn't a crisis pregnancy? Well, he sent an angel to Joseph. And the angel comes to Joseph and says, listen, I know you're a man with a plan, but I got a new plan for you, man, and it is this. I want you to be a husband to her and a father to the child growing inside of her. In fact, the very first thing that the angel said to Joseph in terms of instructions was, do not be afraid to take Mary as your wife. In other words, the very first thing that the angel did was affirm the sanctity of marriage and family consistent with God's design, and then mm-hmm. told him who Jesus was. So what you see in the biblical narrative is the sanctity of marriage and family and the sanctity of life.
Yeah, that's very good. You know, I have such mixed feelings about Donald Trump, as who some people call the greatest pro-life president ever. Yeah, he has certain judicial appointments and some other things as far as Title X Planned Parenthood funding and so forth. On the other hand, what kind of an example is he in terms of compassion and personal life and so forth? I mean, I see some positives, some negatives. I have trouble coming out on one side or the other, and I could use some help in thinking this through.
You know, there's no question that he has actually done things that other Republican pro-life presidents or just pro-life presidents in general have said they were going to do, but just didn't actually do. You know, I think politics is an imperfect business. I mean, I feel like, you know, God uses imperfect people to accomplish, you know, different purposes. So, you know, I think from my perspective, I've been thankful that there has been that focus. And to me, it's not just the president. It's also about, like, who are the people in the administration as well? For example, I know of many people who are in the administration who are people of compassion around the life issue. And so that's the other piece, too, that's part of the dynamic that are making, you know, legislative changes, policy changes, changes in agencies. And I guess for me, you know, you have to kind of look and say, well, you know, is your single issue thing the best single issue thing to be kind of focused against? And it's a challenge mm-hmm. because I think, you know, if you look at our, you know, the whole notion around, you know, life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. Well, if you don't have life, you don't even have to have a discussion about liberty right. or the pursuit of happiness. Life is the first thing. You know, CareNet, from a perspective, you know, we're not on the advocacy side. I mean, we obviously we're engaged mm-hmm. at some level, but our core issue is on the care side. And regardless of who's president or who's not, it doesn't change what needs to happen on the care side. You know, regardless of what happens with the laws, and that, again, we want to advocate for justice and mercy and all those things in that context, the reality is we still have the ability to change the heart of man and the hearts of men and women around something, even if it's legal. It can still be unthinkable.
Now, that is very helpful. Just want to ask about racial issues. As you know, that I guess in New York City there are many more black babies aborted than born alive. I guess the CDC statistics, black women have an abortion rate maybe 3 or even 4 times more than white women.
Yeah.
People have done paint on the streets. Black Lives Matter. There were some pro-lifers who wanted to say, you know, unborn Black Lives Matter. Mm-hmm. Is that a good thing to do, or does that seem to denigrate racial issues, or how do you come out on that?
Ostensibly, the phrase, the hashtag, is really focused on life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, and so you need to have a, you know, as Dr. Tony Evans, who I love, not a term life perspective, but a whole life perspective, which goes from the womb to the tomb. Which, by the way, is what Jesus did, mm-hmm. went from the womb to the tomb, right? So to me, you know, you're not legitimate in terms of talking about this issue if you're not apportioning compassion towards the most vulnerable as well. Mm-hmm. You know, I'm a black man. I'm like this all day, I wake up every morning. I'm like, oh, there it is. I'm black again, you know? And so I have a perspective on this. And, you know, when I started to think about the life issue through that lens, what dawned on me is a perspective that you have to have in order to support abortion. The child that she's carrying is a net negative for her, for society at large. This child is a net negative. Nothing good can come. It's not like 50-50. It's like, no, 51% is negative. So it's better for this child not to come into the world, right? That's what you have to believe.
Yeah.
So if a woman was about to have an abortion and someone came in and said, listen, we got this news that the child that you're carrying, when this child is 17, is going to have some discovery that's going to make this child the richest person in the world, and the woman's about to have the abortion, do you think she'd continue with the abortion? Probably not. Her current situation didn't change. What changed?
Right.
How you viewed the child. It went from being a net negative to a net positive. Do you see? So the way I think about this in the context of race, if black women are aborting their babies and our babies, you know, kids who look like me, at three times the rate, that means that black women believe that on average, their kids are more likely to be net negative. And that the community that supports that her in that decision and encourages that decision and markets that perspective to her actually believes the same thing. That black kids on average are more likely to be net negatives. Now, who believed that? Well, Margaret Sanger did, and other eugenicists and racists and the Klan, and you see what I'm saying? So I just refuse to believe that about myself and my offspring and my people. And so to me, if you're a black person who's like subscribing to this and have allowed this issue to be reframed as empowerment or some other nonsense, you're buying into a notion that our kids on average are three times more likely to be a net negative for the culture. And I just refuse to believe that about myself and about my people. And why I, you know, again, you can't have that perspective about the lives of black people and not have that view about the lives of black people in the womb. If you're focused on, you know, George Floyd, when the officer's got a knee on the throat and he said, I can't breathe, but you're not focused on the child in the womb that's fighting for its first breath, to me, you're not legitimate. You're not legitimate in terms of about caring about my people, so to speak.
Yeah, no, that's very helpful. I have one more issue to ask you about, which may be a battle within CareNet. I know there's debate at various crisis pregnancy centers here in Texas about whether they should prescribe birth control or not. You know, there's The Source, which is now, I think, five different pregnancy resource centers in Texas have united, and they're doing it or going to be doing it. And then some people object to that. And yeah, how do you come out on that? How are you giving guidance, or are you being asked about this?
Yeah, no, we've done some videos and had some conversations about this, but I mean the position of CareNet as a ministry and our affiliates is not to offer birth control, because for a lot of reasons, I mean it's sort of a conflicting message, that you're basically, you know, encouraging a kind of behavior that basically is not biblical in terms of the construct. You know, I mean, Jesus never violated a principle in order to do a good. And I understand like the narrative, well, that if you don't offer them birth control, then they may go out and have an unplanned pregnancy and all those kinds of things. I understand that. And I've got to certainly have a understanding of how difficult that can be. But, you know, you don't violate a biblical principle in order to support a biblical principle. It's just, it's a house divided against itself, and you become double-minded. And I think the other thing too, which I think is deceptive in this, the theory behind this is that this person, you're building this relationship. And what you're actually doing is you're making an idol of relationship. That's what you're doing. Because you're basically saying, there's the biblical principle in terms of what we should be doing around sex. And then there's the relationship piece. And basically what you're saying is maintaining this relationship with this client is more important than upholding this biblical principle about sex outside of marriage. So you basically are making an idol out of a relationship. Well, when you make an idol out of a relationship, what does the Bible say about that? Anything, no matter how good that thing may be, if you make it an idol that's above God, it becomes something that's not good. And so that's what they're basically saying. I'm going to do this in order to preserve the relationship. Now, what happens when that person comes to you and said, you know what, I was using birth control, but now I'm pregnant. I want you to go now with me to have the abortion. Oh, no, no, I can't do that. Well, why not? Well, it's unbiblical to have an abortion. Well, wait a minute. You've been giving me birth control and that's unbiblical. So tell me again why you can't support me. Don't you want to, quote, preserve the relationship? Right. You see what I'm saying? You're on a slope there. So I think the other thing too, which I think is very problematic here, is that if you think that this person is actually going to come back to you when they're facing an unplanned pregnancy, I think that is a bit unrealistic to think that that's actually going to be the case. And they're going to come back to you to help them bring the child into the world when they were coming to you to not get pregnant.
Mm-hmm.
A good way to think about it is if you have a friend who's an alcoholic, right? And all the other friends have been giving this person alcohol in order to preserve the relationship. And now the person comes to the point that they want to get clean and they don't want to drink anymore. Do you think they're going to go to the person who's been giving them the alcohol? No, they'll go to that one friend who said, you know what? I'm going to make truth, the word of God, truth primary here. That's the person they're going to go to. They're not going to go back to the person who's been enabling them. They're going to go back to the one person who stood up and said, you know what? I'm not going to make an idol out of the relationship with you. See, if you love people, what is love? Love is actually truth and compassion in balance. That's what love is.
Mm-hmm.
1 Corinthians 13, two things love is. It rejoices in truth, right? And it's patient and kind, which is compassion. So if you love someone, what you're actually doing is you're balancing truth and compassion. Now, here's the thing. Truth without compassion is harsh, but compassion without truth, right, is also not love.
Mm-hmm. Right. Yep.
It devolves actually into sentimentality because compassion is an action word, which means you have to take action. And what action should you take? Action that's true. So if that person comes back to you, they know that you love them. Why? I was willing to share the truth with you with compassion, even though I knew that it may cause a break in our relationship. Remember Jesus with the rich young ruler? He didn't value relationship over anything. And he knew the guy was going to walk away sad. But he didn't say, you know what? In order to maintain this relationship, I'm not going to share the truth. I'm going to enable him to walk in the idolatry, which in this case was what was the thing that he had, right? It wasn't the sex outside of marriage. It was his money. And Jesus said, you know what?
Yeah.
I want to maintain the relationship with this guy, but there's a higher thing. There's a higher ethic. It's called love. And for me to love him, that means I'm going to have to share the compassion with truth, even if it means he's going to walk away.
Right.
And I think that that's such a powerful story and relevant here because we don't know what happened to the rich young ruler. And I think that that's very important because I think God's saying, listen, ain't your business. Your business is to love folk, right?
Right?
The Bible says they will know us by our love, but it doesn't say they will love us for our love. And we don't know. Right. The rich young ruler could have come back later, whatever. Could have been somebody who was watching and said, wow, look how he loved this guy. Guy comes back later and says, you know what? You helped me unburden this. How many times has that happened in our life? And that's what I'm saying. That's the person that alcoholic is going to go back to, the person who loved them and loved them enough to share the truth with compassion and didn't make an idol out of relationship. Because whenever you have any idol above God, it always leads to sin and destruction.
That's helpful. Now, I suspect CareNet is going to lose some centers over this. Maybe you already have, but I gather you're not willing to make an idol of that relationship and just say, yeah, come and see, we'll break our standards in order for you to stay in CareNet. Have you had discussions about this with any center directors? Have you been able to influence them not to go in that direction?
Well, first off, we've had, I mean, a handful of centers that have gone the other direction. Very few. We have 1,100 affiliates in the U.S. and Canada. I think there were, I don't know, three or four, maybe five or something that decided to move in this direction. And so we did some conference calls and various other things. I did some videos about it and basically shared with them what I just shared with you from a biblical perspective. Don't make an idol out of relationship. You're called to love people. And that means truth and compassion and balance. And, you know, people starting to see that. But our sinners, they understand that because they understand the gospel. And so it hasn't really been a big issue. It hasn't been a big issue for people even doing that. And we just did our new affiliation thing, and we actually have a higher number of affiliates this year than we did last year. So, you know, it gets a lot of news in the press, but within CareNet's community, really folk understand that, you know, I'm called to love and follow the biblical principles.
That was Marvin Olasky's 2020 interview with CareNet President and CEO Roland Warren. I'm Jill Nelson. Thanks for listening.
Additional support comes from Samaritan Ministries, a community of Christians who, through prayer, encouragement, and financial support, will care for you when you have a medical need. When the body of Christ comes together to provide for one another, burdens are lifted and God is glorified. This applies to all areas of life, including healthcare. More at SamaritanMinistries.org/worldpodcast.